coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware lawmakers are wrapping up their work in 2025 after a legislative session often marked by uncertainty and tension.
There are arguments out there that this adjustment period is something every new governor goes through, but I will say we're seeing some rather unprecedented levels of conflict between Governor Matt Meyer and the legislature.
Delaware Public Media state politics reporter Sarah Petrovich joins us to examine the ups and downs at Lake Hall this year. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also get an update on Delaware's affordable housing crisis and efforts to address it. Arts Playlist previews the Southern Delaware Orchestra's summer season. And Enlighten Me features more stories from University of Delaware student journalists. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. State lawmakers have just one day of work left in the 2025 portion of the current legislative session, the first session under new Governor Matt Meyer. As they work to get a few more bills to the finish line on June 30th, we take some time on The Green this week to look back at what Governor Meyer and the General Assembly were and weren't able to accomplish this year. Earlier this week, Delaware Public Media state politics reporter Sarah Petrovich joined me in studio to dive into this year's legislative scorecard. Uncertain and unsettled seem to be the words that may best characterize this year at Lake Hall. Let's start with what is probably the most important thing, the budget. No real issues delivering a spending plan for FY26, but as you've reported, the picture much less rosy in coming years, and there are looming concerns about diminishing federal funds from the Trump administration. Governor Meyer, in his State of the State, called for new tax brackets for higher-end earners to produce some more revenue, but that idea stalled, at least for now. Where do Governor Meyer and lawmakers go from here when it comes to the budget?
Yes, the economic outlook for the upcoming fiscal year, which starts July 1st, seems pretty solid, federal funding uncertainty aside. But as you said, the out years are really where the concerns lie. While the state appears to have the money to cover the next budget, which grows spending by 7.3%, Delaware's spending money at a rate that is far outpacing its revenue growth. In fact, the state's official panel of economic advisors, known as DFAC, is projecting the state could enter a true deficit just two fiscal years from now. They're predicting by fiscal year 28, the state could drain its entire budget reserve account and still be in a $480 million deficit. So in the words of Republican Representative Lyndon Yurig from his comments on the House floor Tuesday, quote, judgment day is coming. He said that before voting no on the $6.58 billion operating budget, although it did pass with the majority of Republicans in support. That's on the Senate agendas today, and then it's up to Meyer to give it the final seal of approval. And as far as looking under the couch cushions for more change, as you mentioned earlier this year, Governor Meyer proposed adding three new personal income tax brackets for high earners to raise more revenue for the state. There was a bill filed mirroring this exact proposal, and it never made it to its first committee hearing. The Speaker of the House, Melissa Minor Brown, says she feels like Meyer's current proposal won't provide enough relief to lower-income Delawareans, but she does say something needs to be done and that something will be done, but that leadership needs more time to weigh options. Another Meyer proposal was a tobacco tax increase, which Melissa Minor Brown spearheaded. It would have increased the cigarette tax by $1.50, among other things. But that bill also appears to be dead. It never received a hearing, and the legislature would have to suspend the rules to bring it forward either later today or on Monday. Democratic leadership did release a statement once the State Budget Writing Committee finalized the operating budget that Senate and House leadership would be working throughout the summer to modernize Delaware's income tax code. They also said they expect greater clarity on the federal budget's impact this fall, and from there they will assess whether additional revenue is needed. So we could see the Speaker call a special session in the fall to look into personal income tax legislation, but we're not expecting those changes in the next few days.
Would the special session largely be if the changes in federal funding kind of force their hand more immediately, then if that's not as big an issue, maybe they just wait until January?
Yeah, that seems to be the case. I mean, I don't think they want to make any rash decisions too quickly. They've made that pretty clear that they want to spend some time on this, getting it right, because it's such a permanent change, of course.
So let's talk a little bit about education funding, because that was front and center this year, specifically developing a new education funding formula. Governor Meyer said he wanted a framework passed before the end of session here on June 30th. The Public Education Funding Commission did approve a set of recommendations, and one of those was to adopt a hybrid funding framework. How much work left is left to be done? And is this the significant progress that Governor Meyer was seeking?
The Public Education Funding Commission did vote to approve a very loose framework for how it intends to change Delaware's disbursement of public education funds. All we really know is the commission is recommending the adoption of, as you said, a hybrid funding framework that blends elements of Delaware's current unit count system with what they're calling a, quote, weighted block grant approach. But as we've noted before, the key word is framework. The formula is still to come. That formula will decide how the state weights funding for vulnerable student populations, like students with disabilities and English language learners. So not only do we not know what those weights are yet, we aren't even sure which vulnerable populations will be receiving more funding. For example, it's pretty clear the commission will be recommending weighted funding for students with disabilities, English language learners, and low-income students. But students experiencing homelessness, for example, could also be in the mix. And there's still so many pieces of the puzzle here, like how the state will improve equalization, which levels the playing field for districts with more property wealth, as well as referendum reform. The commission will begin meeting monthly again in July to tackle all these aspects of the formula, so there is still lots of work to be done. Once the commission voted on the framework, Governor Meyer released a statement that said, quote, "I asked for progress by this summer and the members of the PEFC delivered." While this is partially true, in his State of the State address, the governor called specifically on the state legislature to, quote, pass a holistic funding reform framework before they begin their summer vacation. And he doubled down on this request in an interview back in May. So it seems as though he walked back his expectations some, and this likely had something to do with Secretary of Education Cindy Martin, who has repeatedly noted developing this funding framework and implementing it is going to take some time.
So let's talk a little bit about the Port of Wilmington. There's been a fair amount of tension surrounding the port and its planned expansion in Edgemoor. There was sparring between the governor and Senate leadership over appointments to the Diamond State Port Corporation Board. Governor Meyer won that battle, but lawmakers reconstituted a port expansion task force to try to have their say here. Through all this, do we have any sense of how close the long-awaited expansion at Edgemoor is to actually happening?
Well, the short answer is no. Several state leaders have made comments that the necessary federal permits for the project are close to being reissued, but that narrative has now been going on for months with no concrete answers for the public on when they will be reissued. Those permits are currently tied up in litigation that Delaware itself is not actually involved in. It's between the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and port operators in Philadelphia and New Jersey. The Port of Wilmington Expansion Task Force, which Meyer's administration has remained absent from due to his frustration with the Senate, entered executive session this week to discuss the permits. The public is not privy to what happens in executive session. And just hours later, the Diamond State Port Corporation Board of Directors met, which Meyer's cabinet secretaries did attend, and updates on the federal permits were also discussed out of the public eye. So despite the status of those permits being up in the air, as far as we know, the Edgemoor Port Expansion Project leaders are still going through with design plans and are predicting they'll break ground on the project around May 2026, with construction completed by December 2028. So the port appears to be proceeding as if the permits will come through, but only time will tell.
Another board has been a point of contention, Sarah, and that is leading to some more uncertainty. That is the Hospital Cost Review Board, created a year ago during the Carney administration. It faces some legal challenges and for a brief period lost its funding. Now that funding is back. What can you tell us about where this board stands right now?
Yeah, the Hospital Cost Review Board has faced strong opposition from the day it was filed in the General Assembly, and it's been an uphill battle ever since. It was arguably the most controversial bill of the legislative session last year. The board was created as a way to help curb Delaware's rising health care costs by creating a politically appointed board to review hospital budgets and make sure those hospitals are adhering closely to the state's health care spending benchmark. Republicans and hospitals and even some Democrats feel the board is governmental overreach, and those arguments could have legal grounds, according to the court system. Christiana Care brought a lawsuit forward against the board, and the Court of Chancery recently denied the state's request to dismiss the case. While the court has yet to rule on the actual merits of the case, a vice chancellor did find Christiana Care's argument that the board could violate Delaware's constitution to be, quote, ripe, and they will proceed with oral arguments. Because of the ongoing litigation, the state's budget writing committee voted to pause funding for the board temporarily, but the body reinstated it just over a week later after legal counsel advised that revoking funding for public officer compensation could be a violation of the Constitution. So now there are constitutional questions on all fronts, which has really put the board in a state of limbo. Although despite all of that, the Hospital Cost Review Board has been convening and its next meeting is scheduled for July 8th, but the board is not supposed to begin reviewing hospital budgets until 2026.
Meyer has also been leading a his own effort when it comes to providing health care cost relief. In his State of the State address, he announced a desire to leverage $500,000 of state funds to eliminate $50 million in medical debt for low-income Delawareans. He also requested the legislature pass a bill that would ensure medical debt does not hurt someone's credit score. Where are we at with all that?
Yeah, the bill to keep medical debt from affecting credit scores has been making its way through the legislature with ease. If it passes in the House today, it will just need the governor's signature to become law. The $500,000 to eliminate $50 million in medical debt is not as simple of a story. The State Budget Writing Committee did not include that figure in the operating budget it sent to the full legislature for approval. Governor Meyer and Speaker Mina Brown held a medical debt press conference earlier this month before the budget was finalized. And when asked about if the funding would be included, Meyer said he would defer to the speaker, but that there are, quote, a lot of moving variables and moving parts, and we're confident we're going to find a way to move forward with the program. Speaker Mina Brown did not elaborate following Meyer's statement. So today we're recording this Thursday morning is really Meyer's last chance to secure that funding because the Budget Writing Committee is drafting the grants and aid bill, which allocates money to nonprofit organizations. Meyer's $500,000 request could be included in the bill's epilogue language, but if it's not, this could be further evidence of a somewhat turbulent relationship between the legislature and the governor.
More of that uncertainty and unsettledness. I want to take a little bit of a trip back in time because one of the biggest stories of the session came early on. The passage of Senate Bill 21 back in March, a controversial effort to revamp Delaware corporation law to ostensibly prevent companies from leaving Delaware to reincorporate elsewhere and thus protect the revenue the state gets from companies incorporating here, the so-called corporate franchise. But since then, things have gotten a bit cloudy. Several legal challenges to this bill, and it feels like it remains kind of a real wait-and-see type of legislation in terms of its impact. Is that a fair assessment that this is still pretty much kind of crossing our fingers and seeing what happens?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a fair assessment. Updates to Delaware's general corporation law had long passed without so much as a blink of an eye. These types of bills are written by a council of lawyers who specialize in corporate law and work to maintain Delaware's status as a favorable state for businesses to incorporate in. And this is the state's second largest revenue stream behind personal income tax. So this idea of protecting the franchise goes hand in hand with protecting the fiscal health of the state. But just over a decade ago, lawmakers started to come forward and call for more transparency when it comes to these types of updates. These bills are often incredibly lengthy and difficult to understand, not even just for the average person, but also for legislators themselves. And this year, all those concerns really came to a head with SB 21 because it involved big names like Elon Musk and the decision for major corporations like Tesla and Dropbox to leave the state. And once there were threats from other tech giants like Meta to leave Delaware, lawmakers were worried there would be this mass exodus. And this bill was crafted, like you said, with the hopes of keeping other companies from leaving the state. But opponents of the changes argued they remove protections for minority shareholders because it reduces the threshold necessary for conflicted transactions when a majority stockholder stands on both sides of the deal. And really that this bill was a way to appease these big name Musk-esque CEOs. The bill received some pretty substantial debate in the House, but it still passed in both chambers and was quickly signed into law by Governor Meyer, who pushed hard for the bill's passage. And almost just as quickly, lawsuits began springing up. A pension fund is suing Dropbox over its decision to reincorporate in Nevada, but part of that suit is requesting the Court of Chancery to declare the corporate law changes to be unconstitutional. And then earlier this month, the Delaware Supreme Court said it would be directly taking up the constitutionality of the changes. So now we just play the waiting game.
It will be something to keep an eye on, particularly in the courts, over the course of the summer before the legislators come back again next year or in a special session. One other issue that's been on the front burner in more recent weeks and was resolved this week was the session-long absence of State Representative Stel Parker Selby, who resigned on Tuesday. Can you walk us through what happened here and what's next?
Yeah, Democratic Representative Parker Selby narrowly won re-election to her Milton area seat in November and then suffered a severe stroke in December, a month prior to the start of the legislative session. That health incident kept her from attending any session days in Dover and from casting a single vote on behalf of her constituents, which became a growing narrative of concern as the legislature progressed. Parker Selby was ceremonially sworn into office within her home in March, but she never publicly commented on her condition. It all came to a head this month when Speaker of the House Melissa Mina Brown was being consistently pressed on Parker Selby's condition and if she would be returning to Legislative Hall. Then some Republican lawmakers started calling for Parker Selby's resignation, and one fellow Democratic representative, Medina Wilson-Anton, called for her resignation. After that, within days, Parker Selby announced her resignation on Facebook. I do want to point out, representatives on both sides of the aisle reiterated their love and care for Parker Selby, but the main concern was that she was not healthy enough to serve in the seat, which Parker Selby later confirmed in her own resignation letter. Her seat is in District 20, which registered Democrats hold a very slim majority in, and nearly one-third of the district is registered as other. The seat was long held by a Republican prior to Parker Selby's election in 2022, and the GOP has been vying to flip that seat back. In fact, former Cape Henlopen High School principal and Republican Nikki Miller lost to Parker Selby by only 245 votes this past election, and she officially filed to run for the seat again in a special election. As far as a special election to fill the vacancy, Speaker Minor Brown has just over a week to issue a writ of election, and then an election must take place between 30 to 35 days from when the writ is issued. And really quickly, just to add further nuance to the situation, when it comes to special elections, it's up to county party leadership to nominate a candidate. So instead of a primary, selected party candidates immediately go head-to-head. This is a process Governor Meyer has publicly condemned in the past, but party leadership and lawmakers believe state code would need to be changed to hold a primary. So we'll be keeping an eye out to see if the governor re-ups his request for this special election primary.
More summer fun. We'll be... We've been talking a lot about unsettled and uncertain issues, but there have been a number of things that were actually accomplished this session. We don't want to minimize that. Two that come to mind are medically assisted suicide and an inspector general. Both things have been discussed for years. Medically assisted suicide finally passed and was signed by the governor. Inspector general appears to be on track. It looks like these might be the two signature things that get done this session.
Yes, medical aid in dying, commonly referred to as physician-assisted suicide, had a difficult go-around last year, although it's a bill that has been introduced in the General Assembly for over a decade. After squeaking by in the House, it had to go through two rounds of votes in the Senate, only to be vetoed by Governor John Carney on moral grounds. It was brought back this year, and although there was substantial debate in both chambers, it passed and was signed into law by Governor Meyer in May. The new law is expected to take effect in January. And a bill to create an office of the Inspector General is another one that has stalled year after year, but it passed unanimously among members present in the Senate last month. It's not on the House agenda today. Again, we're recording this on Thursday, but it's likely going to pass on Monday. $1.4 million in annual funding for the office is already included in the proposed operating budget. If signed into law, the bill would create an independent, nonpartisan office that would investigate potential fraud, waste, mismanagement, etc. The creation of this office is something Governor Meyer campaigned on and contributes to larger calls for better state transparency, something Delaware consistently ranks poorly in.
In recent years, Sarah, we've also seen lawmakers try to tackle some big issues through a package of bills that address various aspects of any given issue. Are there any packages like that that have made progress this year?
Yeah, they've almost been more so bundles than packages. So a lot of bills that relate but are not necessarily introduced as a package per se. But freshman state representative Mara Gorman did file a true four-bill package to protect civil liberties, intending to ban citizens' arrest, civil arrest in courthouses without a judicial warrant, and private prisons. She also has immigration protection legislation out there, and State Representative Sean Lynn has at least six bills floating around that all relate to immigration protection. These bills largely relate to prohibiting federal law enforcement, mainly ICE, from partnering with local police agencies to carry out deportation efforts, as well as prohibiting data sharing practices on the citizenship status of Delawareans. There's also a slate of bills related to fostering better school board transparency, as well as almost too many bills to count related to curbing energy costs and providing energy bill relief after a lot of Delawareans experience unusually high winter energy bills, and now more price hikes have gone into effect for the summer. Most of these bills are in the home stretch of getting through the General Assembly, and then hopefully Governor Meyer has a lot of pens on hand.
One of the heavier lift for lawmakers is passing constitutional amendments. They require a two-thirds majority in both chambers in two separate two-year sessions to succeed. Any progress on moving any of these amendments forward this year?
Yeah, there were a couple of high-profile constitutional amendments filed this year. Several of them relate to voting procedures. Two are from State Senator Darius Brown. One would constitutionalize early voting in Delaware, and the other would constitutionalize permanent and no-excuse absentee voting, also known as vote by mail. Those two amendments cleared the Senate and passed their necessary committee in the House, so now they only need a full vote on the House floor. They are not on today's agenda, so if they were to pass this session, they would have to go to the floor on Monday. But I should also note that this most recent legislative legislative stretch from January to June is what's called the first leg of the 153rd General Assembly. And as you mentioned, for constitutional amendments to pass entirely, they have to be approved in a subsequent General Assembly. So even if these first leg constitutional amendments don't pass by June 30th, as long as they pass by next June 30th, their overall success is still in good shape because they need to make a comeback in 2027 or 2028 regardless. But there is one hot button constitutional amendment that seems to be on track to pass this session, and that's outlawing the death penalty in Delaware. I should note that capital punishment is not currently enforceable in Delaware, not only based on a Supreme Court decision, but also because lawmakers removed the provision from Delaware Code last year based on that decision. But the door is still open as of now to introduce a law to either bring the death penalty back in a legal way or abolish it entirely. And State Representative Sean Lynn's constitutional amendment would do the latter. That amendment passed in the House earlier this week, gaining the necessary two votes from Republicans that it needs. It's going to go through the Senate Executive Committee today and then could either be added to today's agenda or Monday's if it clears that committee hearing. And if it reaches the Senate floor, it's likely to pass because Democrats have a supermajority in that chamber.
So we've had a lot of conversation centering on controversial, contentious legislation and or situations. And while that's not terribly uncommon in Dover, it does feel like there's been a bit more this year. Can this be chalked up to this being the first year of a new administration, everybody kind of getting their bearings? Or could this be the start of a bit more combative trend at Legge Hall?
Yeah, you know, there are arguments out there that this adjustment period is something every new governor goes through. In recent weeks, I've had discussions where people say the same was said about former Governor John Carney when he first took over for Governor Jack Markell, but then eventually eased in. So there's something to be said about how the transition to a new administration can be dysfunctional regardless. But I will say we're seeing some rather unprecedented levels of conflict between Governor Matt Meyer and the legislature, and this started prior to his election, right? Any Democratic lawmaker that was endorsing a gubernatorial candidate in the Democratic primary, except for one, was endorsing Meyer's opponent, Bethany Hall Long. Even the Delaware Democratic Party endorsed her. She served in both chambers of the General Assembly and was lieutenant governor at the time of the election, which means she was presiding over the Senate. So she had a pretty close relationship with lawmakers. And to be fair, Meyer campaigned on breaking up the Delaware way. He is a strong proponent of getting rid of this insider way of conducting political business. So while his public relationship with the legislature has appeared to be pretty combative, so much so that he took them to the Supreme Court over nominations to the Diamond State Port Corporation Board, he did say that he wants to go against the grain, right? You could argue he's doing exactly what he said he would do. And also in terms of this strained relationship being more heightened than just an adjustment period, there's been some pretty damning comments made about Meyer by lawmakers publicly, specifically referring to a statement from State Senator Darius Brown during one of the Port of Wilmington Expansion Task Force meetings. Meyer's decided to not send any of his cabinet secretaries to those meetings, as we said, even though they are legally members of the board, because they feel it was a way for the General Assembly to provide unnecessary oversight to the expansion project. And in his comments, Brown said Meyer's behavior is, quote, as if the high school nerd became the prom king, and publicly reprimanded him for cozying up to businesses that go against the port's interests, using egg timers with legislators during meetings, and also signing performative executive orders. He also said, quote, Matt is not king, using the governor's first name, and that the executive branch is not a dictatorship, and called on the governor to do better when it comes to working with legislators. So I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that the relationship between the state legislature and the governor is strained. I think we'll continue to watch that play out with the port expansion project. But also even in just the next few days on if Meyer's $500,000 in medical debt relief is added to the budget, as well as if he signs off on the budget entirely. I also do want to mention there's additional turmoil within the Democratic caucus and the House following this election due to the growing number of members that are endorsed by the Working Families Party, which is a more progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Representatives who are members of the Working Families Party have publicly accused the Speaker of the House for using retaliation tactics against them when they don't vote in line with the party. And even in just recent days, State Representative Sharia Moore filed a cease and desist against Speaker Minor Brown due to what she's calling defamatory comments made about her following her very public removal from the House Education Committee, which she was vice chair of, after it came to light that she was briefly teaching on an expired teaching license. So that's just another thing to keep an eye on when it comes to the combativeness within the legislature.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media State Politics reporter Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Contributor Eileen Dalabrita offers us a snapshot of where Delaware stands in its effort to deliver more affordable housing. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Affordable housing, specifically the lack of it, is an issue that's been in the headlines in Delaware and nationwide for a few years now. And there's no shortage of government agencies, lawmakers, nonprofits, and housing advocates trying to find new and creative ways to deliver solutions. This week, contributor Eileen Dallarita takes a deeper dive into what the issue looks like here in the First State and some of the responses to it. Her snapshot of affordable housing in Delaware is available at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to discuss what she learned. So, Eileen, let's set the table first. What is the scope of the affordable housing issue right now in Delaware?
Well, the Delaware State Housing Authority puts the number of needed affordable units at 19,000. And overall, Delaware is short 50,000 housing units. And to give us an idea of how great the problem is in terms of affordability, there are currently 20,357 people on the waiting list that combines all five of Delaware's housing authorities.
That is a lot of people who are trying to find a place that they can afford. How did we get to this point? Are there some factors that help create these conditions that we are seeing right now?
Well, I think a lot of our listeners remember 2008 and the housing bust when much of home building came to a screeching halt. That said, the problem goes back even further. There just hasn't been enough housing that's affordable being built for quite some time. The emphasis has been on single-family homes, on generous lots, rather than high-density housing.
And are there particular areas of the state where this is more of an issue, or at least more acute? Do different areas face different needs, different issues?
For being such a small state, Delaware is incredibly diverse, and the needs are indeed different. There is an affordable housing shortage in the city of Wilmington, absolutely. There are folks who have been priced out of the market in Kent County. And in Sussex County, where there's a lot of construction going on, there's not much happening in the way of affordable housing. Places for the home health aides, the service workers, the folks who essentially take care of the more affluent people who are buying the big, beautiful new homes.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, it sounds like in our reporting, is in Sussex County, you know, the idea that you have a lot of high-end homes in the resort beach area, but the people who teach at the schools there, work in the hospitals there, to find somewhere affordable, they have to move far away to the other end of Sussex County or maybe into Kent County to find somewhere that they can live, and then they got a commute to deal with.
Yeah, Sussex County is a big county.
So what are some of the things that the Delaware State Housing Authority is doing to address the situation?
Well, the waiting list I mentioned earlier is an important step forward. Previously, waiting lists were disjointed, and some of them opened and closed, and home seekers were left wondering when they would get a chance to get in line. The new statewide list is easy to access. And then there are a number of projects, including Amani Village, the redevelopment of the Riverside Housing Project in Wilmington. And it's a new model where instead of creating these barrack-style apartments where residents are essentially marooned from services, the project includes social services that will help the people who live there lead healthier, more productive lives.
So certainly there's that piece of the puzzle, this Delaware State Housing Authority, well-positioned to try some of these things. But there are others who are making an effort to get some things done, including lawmakers in the General Assembly and other places, Sussex County Council, Newcastle County Council. What are some of the things that lawmakers are trying or considering trying to get at this problem, at least in some way, shape, or form?
Well, Senate Bill 87, and this is the second go-round with this proposal, is advocating for statewide approval for ADUs or granny flats. And that would allow homeowners to build additions either to their house, over the garage, whatever, or standalone homes on their properties and rent them out. It's a concept that has been very successful in places with in housing crisis like California.
I was going to say, and it's built, I guess, on the kind of original concept of having like an in-law suite or an in-law place, you know, where you would maybe in the past like have your mother or your father who is older and you want them to live with you, but not like within your house. It's that type of style of living, but made open to like rent to other people.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and it's been very successful in California, and it doesn't take a long time to say outfit that space over your garage for a studio apartment. It's quick.
What are some of the more creative out-of-the-box ideas you saw when you were doing your reporting? Because obviously this is not a one-size-fits-all answer that can be found to affordable housing. And we've seen some creative out-of-the-box ideas. Can you tell us a bit about some of those and if there's any indication that some of them have a better chance of success than others?
Well, Little Living, it's a nonprofit developer, is building a village, a cluster of 10 to 20 one-bedroom and two-bedroom homes in Georgetown. They're very small, ranging from 400 to 600 square feet. And it's getting people's motors going who want to help. Two local landowners each donated an acre for the development, and rents there would range from $850 to $1,000 a month and include utilities and internet service. And they're expanding to Kent County. They're under contract to develop 27 acres there. And that would be 200 to 220 homes that will be sold, as well as 40 to 50 rental properties. And plans also are in play for a mini village in Milford. So will groupings of mini homes work? I think it's an idea whose time has come.
I'm curious with that type of idea or even some of the other things that you've talked about, like the ADUs, is there a certain NIMBY concern that's out there that makes this hard to do, that some people are concerned that these type of things will hurt the value of their current home that they own? Is that a hurdle that has to be kind of overcome in any of these ideas moving forward?
I think so. You know, when you have a concept like Living Little, they've essentially are in tracks where nobody else is living right now. But I would imagine that if somebody wants to build a second home in their backyard, that there might be some pushback from neighbors. It's going to be something that will generate controversy.
It took some time, Eileen, to get into this predicament. How long might it take to get out? Is there optimism that there are enough tools in the toolbox, these things that we're talking about, to make some real progress, both short-term and long-term?
Well, how long it will take to turn the ship around depends on how quickly we can produce high-quality homes. Housing advocates say, build, baby, build. But there has to be more of an emphasis on high-density homes, because we can't plop a house on every square inch of Delaware. So if we're going to build our way out of this crisis, we have to be smart about it.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time this week. Her snapshot of affordable housing in the first state is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, Arts Playlist, and a look ahead to the upcoming Southern Delaware Orchestra summer season. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Southern Delaware Orchestra, or SODELO, is hard at work preparing for a summer concert series featuring a guest conductor, a guest soloist, and the orchestra's debut appearance at the Freeman Arts Pavilion. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny gets a preview of SODELO's summer season with violinist Steve Greifer, SODELO's co-founder and board president.
before I talk about these summer concerts, Sodelo is not a particularly old orchestra, and I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how this came about and the history of the orchestra.
A little more than three years ago, I moved down to Delaware, and I had been playing in a community orchestra pre-pandemic up in Westchester County, New York. And I wanted to find some people to play music with when I moved down here. I put a post up on Facebook and got a response of about 30 people, 30 string players, saying that they wanted to play. And one of the string players was a woman named Eva Delgallo, who said, "Forget about duets and quartets, Steve. We've got enough people here to put together an orchestra." And then about a year and a half in, we always wanted to expand to being a full orchestra. And we had the opportunity to do that through an association with AARP. They came to us and said, "Can you work with us on a performance at the Grand Opera House in Wilmington? But we need a full orchestra to accompany a Broadway soloist." So we quickly pulled together winds, brass, and percussion, and we became a full symphony orchestra. And we're on a huge upward trajectory. But just from a little, "Do you want to play duets, anyone out there," to where we are today, it's been a crazy ride.
And you've got a guest conductor coming in, right?
We do. Steven Zarkowski is a very accomplished cellist and conductor. He's conducted the National Symphony. He's the chief conductor of the Central Pennsylvania Symphony. He plays with the Newark Symphony. And a lot of the people in the orchestra had played with him before. So it was sort of a natural step as we were looking for a guest conductor. And Steven really is a great guy who really fits in with the karma of the orchestra and who we are.
And you've also got a guest soloist appearing this summer as well, right?
Yes, that's so exciting. Another member of the family. Makita is going to sing a lot of the American classics. We have some Broadway pieces, and I know that the audience is going to be very excited, just as the audiences at the Metropolitan Opera and the Lyric Opera at Chicago have been when they've had a chance to hear Makita in the past.
Well, we've talked about who's going to be performing. Tell me what they're going to be performing. What will the repertoire be on these summer concerts?
The program is called the Summer Celebration of America's Music, and it really focuses in on the greatness of the iconic composers like Aaron Copland and George Gershwin, Leroy Anderson. And I would say with some confidence that people will recognize 85% of the music and perhaps even sing along with some of it. And then as part of our ethos and our mission, we always want to challenge the musicians on stage, and we want to expand our repertoire and our musicianship. So some classical fans would say, "Well, if you're going to play Aaron Copland for a summer concert, I know the pieces that you're going to play." Well, in this case, we're going to introduce things that people don't necessarily know about Aaron Copland as well. So it's that right mix for people who just want to come to a concert and hear the hits and hear the favorites and sing along and enjoy a summer afternoon or a summer evening. But we're also going to introduce some new music to people that love the other music as well. And that's really part of what Sodelo is about, is introducing the joy of orchestral music to Southern Delaware.
One thing that's new for Sodelo this summer, you're taking the show to Milford, and there's some extra significance to this Milford show in terms of the location, right?
We're so excited about going to Milford for a lot of different reasons. I think one of the primary reasons that we're excited is one of our hopes and dreams as an orchestra in Southern Delaware is to help encourage the school programs here in Southern Delaware to introduce string education. This is the first high school in Southern Delaware that is introducing string education. So part of our appearance at Milford is really a salute to that and in support of that, and even to help drive interest and maybe gain some momentum for that program in particular, which we hope will then leak into some of the other schools. So to be a part of that is an amazing thing. The other thing about expanding to Milford is it's really part of our mission to be the Southern Delaware Orchestra. So expanding into new markets is also an important part of what we're trying to do. And Milford is an obvious great new market. It also sort of touches the Dover area. So we're hoping to bring music again, orchestral music, to that region as well.
Where can folks see the orchestra this summer? Where will you be playing and when?
So we have two concerts in July that are sort of our traditional concerts. The first one is going to be in Milford at Milford High School on July 19th at 3 p.m. And the second concert is going to be at our home field of K. Penlopen High School in Lewis. And that will be the next day, Sunday, July 20th, also at 3 p.m. Beyond that, we're going to repeat the program that we're playing on the 19th and 20th at the Freeman Stage on August 12th at 7 p.m. But we're going to switch some pieces out, and we have a great surprise. Actually, we have a couple of great surprises that will make it worthwhile for people who may have seen us in July to also come down, enjoy the Freeman Stage environment, and hear us again.
And then finally, thinking past the summer, got a new season coming up. What can you tell us about what's coming up in the fall-winter season?
Well, our next concert after the Freeman Stage concert is going to be a Halloween celebration. It's going to be a pops-oriented, family-oriented concert that's going to be really fun to play and really fun to perform. But speaking about being a young orchestra, we're 3 years old, and the Southern Delaware Chorale is turning 40 this year. And to celebrate their 40th anniversary, they wanted to replay the piece that they started with 40 years ago, which is Handel's Messiah. And they came to us and asked us if we would partner with them in performances of the Messiah. So we're over the moon with that. It's an amazing collaboration between two great arts organizations in Southern Delaware, and we're certainly putting together something that a sum that is greater than the parts here.
Yeah, and I've got to say, if people have never heard the Messiah done with the full chorale and the full orchestra, it is a really amazing experience to see and hear.
I got to say, as you were saying that, and now I'm going to reveal my deep geekdom, but I get chills. I really do.
Thanks to Sodello Board President and co-founder Steve Greifer and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Information about Sodello's summer concerts and tickets are available at sodellomusic.org. And we wrap up the Green next with Enlighten Me, where we highlight more stories from University of Delaware student journalists. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we head back to the University of Delaware one more time to highlight work from student journalists. Pieces produced by UD Communications students for a class taught by Nancy Karamjanian, a longtime First Aid journalist, director of UD's journalism program, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with rising senior Ayanna Register. The southern part of UD's campus is home to many notable areas, such as the U Dairy Creamery, the Star Campus, and Delaware Stadium. But Register points out there's also a hidden gem there worth checking out.
Among the hustle and bustle of traffic and the hum of generators is a lively and colorful garden hidden near U Dairy Creamery. The Botanic Garden director, Lauren Cope, says the University of Delaware Botanic Gardens came from humble beginnings.
It didn't really start with like a big vision or strategic plan of how things were going to be laid out. It just kind of iterated over the course of 40, 50 years. So we were originally developed by faculty in plant and soil science program that were just planting specimens out into the garden to teach from.
The garden is a useful tool for students to gain hands-on experience working in horticulture. That's how current horticulture manager and UD alum, Andrew Adams, got his start.
Because I love the chemistry and I was familiar with landscaping, someone had taught me about soil science courses. And so I got into plant and soil science, took a few courses, and then declared for plant science. And then my junior year, going into my senior year, I took an internship at the UDBG. So I'm a former intern as well there. And I just kind of stuck around until they hired me.
The garden stretches 15 acres. This large space has caused some hardships for the five-person team. Cope and Adams say there are two major issues.
I would say our biggest challenge in the garden is staffing.
The other issues that we have are like storms and weather events can tear us up pretty good.
UDBG interns and volunteers take a lot of the burden off the core team. There's no barrier to entry for volunteers or garden interns. Junior Megan Brooke worked in the Botanic Garden in 2023. She's a sustainable food systems major with an art minor.
I started working at the Botanic Gardens to gain plant experience. Before that internship, I had never had a job working with plants. I had only been in food service.
Her experience broadened her view of agriculture.
I'm really liking doing organic farming right now. So I think knowing how to use a tractor is very useful. Also, the proper skills for weeding and planting. Oh, we did sow some seeds as well. That's also something I do at my current job.
And her hard work wasn't without its surprising moments.
We found out there was a huge, like, fox den. Like, I was looking and we found, like, near this bush, I was like, why is there a huge hole? And so we're all like, what is that?
Many volunteers are retired staff or general retirees. Their hard work brings the community together, especially for UD's annual Ag Day. For Ag Day, the UDBG team goes all out for their plant sale. The UD Botanic Garden, amongst many things, inspires community growth. Adams says that the value of UDBG is as a host space for people to come together.
Somewhere for folks to gather, somewhere for folks to relax, and we are the destination to go to. I think our value is being the host site for friendship.
For UD News, I'm Ayanna Register.
Thanks to rising senior Ayanna Register for her reporting. Next, we hear from another rising senior, Olivia Hoover, who tells us properly fueling your body can help boost the immune system and reduce diseases. And the path to that fueling begins and ends with good nutrition.
The significance of nutrition and the effects of properly fueling has on your body is perhaps the secret to feeling and looking good. Getting needed amount of water, that is, at least 8 glasses a day. Proper sleep, dream on, but that goal is 8 hours of Z's. Eating more healthy food than junk food is the prescription for fueling your body. Austin Mark, UD's Director of Nutrition Performance, says properly fueling can prevent injury, help boost recovery time, and better the immune system, all while maximizing energy levels. Austin Mark whips up his own concoction daily.
Nutrition is so important to me because I've had such a personal connection to it for a very long time. I was an athlete in high school myself, and I've had numerous injuries that have set me back for years and prevented me from playing my sport.
He believes every college student should know some quick, easy meals hitting all of the food groups to maximize energy.
Especially foods that are easy to do, whether you're in a dorm or in an apartment. I like to go to overnight oats. And also, if you have a microwave, sometimes you can have rotisserie chicken and adding in a microwaved rice pouch and then adding in some shelf-stable produce that doesn't need to be refrigerated and helping you get all your food groups while having a complete meal for performance and recovery.
Obviously, Grotto's Pizza isn't the best fuel, especially for student athletes who know all too well what a bad diet and bad sleeping habits can do to a body's performance. UD men's soccer player Mikey Johnson does what he can to fuel up.
I would most likely eat some grilled chicken, some potatoes, maybe a little bit of fruit as well. Eating a good meal like grilled chicken, potatoes, has a lot of carbohydrates, some protein. Just gives me energy to get through the game.
Another UD men's soccer player, Rocco Pastore, has his own plan for fueling.
I'm going to have to go with the New York strip, medium rare, preferably from Texas Roadhouse. When I'm in that final stretch of the game, it really helps my muscle fatigue.
A lot of students are interested in nutrition and health, but just don't know where to start. Austin Mark gives his best advice.
So the best advice I would give someone who's trying to eat healthier is just trying to be 1% better every day. It's not about making 10 different lifestyle changes overnight, especially when you're, you know, in college and looking to make small sustainable changes, but maybe just taking small sustainable changes to getting one more produce, one more bottle of water, one more protein throughout the day.
I'm Olivia Hoover for UD News.
Thanks to University of Delaware Rising Seniors Olivia Hoover and Ayanna Register for enlightening us this week on The Green. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida, UD student journalists Olivia Hoover and Ayanna Register, and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. Our team is taking a break next week for the 4th of July holiday, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.